You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Gruth. Let's get ready.
On your marks, get set, go!
In this story, we're getting into our marks, the ones on our bodies.
One afternoon, I came across a place on the internet that felt like an honest space for me. A birthmark blog. It's mostly sunscreen and makeup reviews for people with their birthmarks. One post jumped out at me. It was a poll. Do you cover your birthmark with makeup? 57% voted that they covered their birthmark all the time, and 25% of the voters never covered their birthmark. In this story, we'll be hearing from three birthmark experts. The first is Angie.
So it's about the size of a large hand, and then it's got some much smaller, lighter patches underneath it. It's on the lower half of my back on the right side, and it's completely flat. There's no texture to it. So, and when I was a young girl and used to look at it in the mirror, I actually thought it was similar to the shape of Ireland.
The second expert is my friend Carl.
Okay, so it's on the bottom left of my cheek. It's right in between my left cheek and my neck. So it's right on that border. It's on my jaw. So it looks a bit like Antarctica. It's slightly tanner than I am. So
I think you would call that cafe au lait.
Yeah.
The third expert is me. I have a birthmark on my right thigh. It's a perfect oval, which means it doesn't look like a country or a continent. It's long and darkish brown. And the skin on my birthmark is incredibly sensitive. A scratch can make me feel like I've been cut and that I'm bleeding. The first time you become aware of your birthmark can be confusing.
I was born with mine. I only noticed later on, when I was around 5, that I had it. So one day, I just look in the mirror, young me, just going, oh, what's that? And I tried to wash it off because I thought it was dirt. But to no avail, you know, didn't work out. And so I thought it was like, just like someone put masking tape on my face and ripped it off or something. My sister probably did it. Those thoughts ran through my mind. And later on, I just realized it was a part of me. And so slowly coming to terms with it, I guess.
Well, I think I was probably about 5 when I realised that it was there and it was staying there. So then I realised also I was the only one in my family with a birthmark, so I started to wonder why it was there. I asked Mum and Dad about it at the time, and there really wasn't an explanation. They couldn't think of anybody in their families who had birthmarks at all. So they kept putting it down to being unique, which only helped for about 30 seconds. So.
When I was in primary school, I would wear longer shorts than the other girls, and I would cross my legs if I was wearing something short. And I still do that.
Well, as a teenager, I definitely became self-conscious of it. You know, I always thought of reasons to wear a t-shirt at the beach. You know, I might go boogie boarding or body surfing, or I bought, you know, swimwear that covered that area. Or sometimes I got friends to apply makeup to it, which always rubbed off. So, and then another example of being a teenager at pool parties, I would run and jump in when no one was behind me so that they wouldn't notice it, or, you know, leave the pool when no one was behind me. You know, just do little things to not raise attention to it.
Sometimes we can even see humour in the way people respond to our birthmark.
Most of my birthmark memories are from the beach. So I would go into the water and think, yes, I'll just have a nice swim. And then usually as I left the water, people would come up to me in a panic and say, you've been stung by a blue bottle, or you've got sea lice, quick, you know, and they're in this panic and I'm going, what? You know? Oh, that's my birthmark. It's okay. Or you've had an allergic reaction to sunscreen. You know, always strangers coming up, usually worried for me, you know. So that always was a bit confronting for me.
That would be good for your self-esteem, could it?
I know. Well, and I mean, I was quite a shy, introverted type, so I really wasn't looking for the attention, good or bad. Really, so the attention was actually more affected me more than the actual birthmark.
Early on in my earlier years in high school, probably year 10, I'd say, I had a series of like, I don't think you'd call it migraines, but I had like a tense sort of headache. And so my doctor told me to go see a neurologist because it could be like my nerves acting up or something. And then he had like a little tape recorder and he was addressing my me as a patient. And he goes, oh, left cheek. What did you say again, Madeline? Café au lait. What was that description you had?
Café au lait.
Yeah, he said that. And then I didn't know what he meant by that. I was like, just to correct him, I said, oh, it's a birthmark. He's like, oh, you don't think I don't know it's a birthmark? I'm like, okay, yeah. So I let him continue addressing me as a patient. And then when he finished, I asked why he asked that. And he said, sometimes people with birthmark have a tendency to have, like, there's a chance for cancer. But he said, you shouldn't worry about it. But just something that happened in my youth.
So the cause of birthmarks is widely unknown. But there are a surprising amount of superstitions about birthmarks. There's a theory that a birthmark is the shape of food the mother was craving during pregnancy. For reddish birthmarks, it could be strawberries. For café au lait birthmarks, it's coffee. So I asked Carl if his mum was a big coffee drinker.
No, I don't think so. I think she drank coffee, but not to the extreme where you'd say it caused my birthmark.
So maybe we could just cross that one off the list.
Yeah.
The myth I've heard the most is that birthmarks are a symbol of how you died in a past life. Maybe I was shot in the leg with a massive bullet or a cannon. Angie has an idea about what happened to her.
I have actually had it pointed out that I was probably a witch in a past life with my particular birthmark being red and splashed on my back. But it was, you know, probably a burn mark from the time in my life that I was a witch. So at the time, you know, it interested me at the time. And I also remember thinking that it wasn't really that helpful either.
So that you were a witch, but you obviously were an Irish witch.
Definitely. It's all coming together now.
It's difficult to think of your birthmark as normal when you see listicles of celebs with the freakiest birthmarks and celebrities embracing their birthmarks, which are mainly comprised of women who have one beauty spot. I get that Cindy Crawford worked through her mole, but it's not really the same.
Having something that's not very common, you have a tendency to kind of self-reflect more than other people. You'd feel a bit different from everyone else. And so without my birthmark, I don't think I'd be who I am today just because of these little details that happen in my life where people would question me on something that was personal. So without those experiences, I don't think I'd be the wise person I am today. Bring you back to the wisdom.
You wouldn't be spitting so much wisdom.
That story was by Madeline Goldberger. The supervising producer was Alison Chan. All the Best exists because we want emerging Australian storytellers to learn how to make audio stories, like the ones you're hearing today. You can pitch to us from any part of Australia and we'll pair you with one of our supervising producers. Email contact@allthebestradio.com to make your mark on the audio scene. Emily loves horses. She likes to take them round the track. She was digging through her family tree and recently found out that horses can take a trip around the ring as well.
There's a certain connection between little girls and ponies that's universally understood. Among dreams of being an actress or a dancer, owning a horse tends to rate pretty high on the list. When I was a little girl, I must have got pretty lucky because somehow I managed to grow up with 30. I was born and raised in Warwick, a rural town in Queensland where agriculture is king. From above, the watered crops and dying grass make the landscape look like a patchwork quilt. It's the kind of place where small talk mostly relates to when we'll next get rain. I grew up on a farm just outside town with 30 horses and a few ratbag Jack Russells to keep me occupied. I can't even remember the first time I rode a horse. It's sort of become second nature, like riding a bike or reading a book. Horses have always been part of my life, and I've often been told that horsemanship is in my blood. But it wasn't until recently that I found out exactly what that meant. Nana Millie is 96, and she lives in an aged care facility on the outskirts of town. On one of my recent visits, she alluded to some horse-related family history I didn't know about. So I've come back with a microphone to pin it down. How many horses would you have had over the years?
About 125, and I've attended the names of every horse.
Could you just?
Yeah, I've got the book somewhere. If I could get those scrapbooks in there, would you get anything out of them?
In her scrapbooks, Nana Millie has kept every photo or mention of her family ever published.
Start with that big one.
That'd be the first one we ever did. No?
Pages of newspaper clippings tell family stories from black and white print. As it turns out, Nana Millie's husband, great-granddad Huey, was a bit of a showman, and he loved his ponies. So much so that he taught them to do tricks with his children. After showing their neighbour one day, Huey was encouraged to perform their tricks as entertainment at the local rodeo.
Well, we were over with Kelly Hayes. He was next to our farm. Mm-hmm. And we were over there one day with the ponies, talking about the ponies. And there was something there that they did with the ponies, jumped something. And Kevin Hayes said, they're smart little ponies. And that's how it all started at the Warwick Show in 1953.
From there, they went on to entertain huge audiences as they travelled around Queensland performing their tricks. They called themselves the Mullins Family Troupe. Nana Millie tells me about each trick as we move through the photos. Horses would lie down with children doing flips over their bodies, race to pick up hats from the ground, ride a seesaw, dance on a table, and even jump through a hoop of fire.
There he is, look, standing. Peter's standing on the horse, and he's standing on that box. That box is 9 inches square at the top, and he's got his 4 feet in that horse, Smokey. Brian's standing up there spinning the rope, and this is Peter jumping through the horse's legs.
The photo is pretty incredible. The horse is balancing precariously on a tiny box, making a V-shape with his legs that a child is diving through. Standing on the horse's back is another child spinning a rope or cracking a whip. The horse could lose balance and fall off at any moment. In the background, another child is holding a horse. This child is my grandmother, Nana Maureen. I headed to her house to see if she could shed a little more light on the topic. Nana takes me back to the early days.
So I was 9 and my brother Brian was a little older, so he would have been 11. So we were 11, 9 and right down to about 2.
The small children and the incredible ponies were all part of the crowd's attraction to the troupe.
And people knew that the famous Mullins troupe were coming. They would always just flock around and just wait and wait and wait until we arrived. Mm-hmm. We came back to Earth with a sudden jolt. We weren't up in the air. We didn't think we were famous for too long. We loved the accolades, but there was no big headedness about us.
She tells me about the coach robbery act, an extravagant trick that involved a large cast, a horse-drawn carriage, and even some gunfire.
At about that stage, we invested in a Cobb & Co. coach. And so we did this was a pretty extravagant role where we had other people come in and we did a coach robbery act. So what happened, we would have four horses in the coach. We had the driver and a co-driver, and in the back we had two little girls, Joyce and I, in little gingham frocks, and then we're galloping around the ring in this stagecoach when a robber suddenly, a horse galloping by, had a gun and started firing bullets, and then there were more people with guns.
As she's telling me about the trick, I take a moment to imagine what it would have been like watching from the crowd. It's the kind of bushranger ambush I've seen so many times in the Western films my dad loves, but they did it all for a live audience. The Coach Robbery Act was a pretty big production, and it stuck with Nana as one of the most impressive tricks she ever did. But for another member of the family, this was just the beginning.
Yes, I sort of remember them old days.
Gary is the youngest of the Mullins bunch, just a baby when the troop started in 54. I popped in to visit him at his Ipswich home to talk about growing up in the troop. When I say he's a baby, he's actually a baby. He's two. There's a photo of him hanging off the side of the horse, Grandad holding him up by his shirt. He doesn't look very secure.
I done a lot more in longer times after them shows, yeah.
As his siblings moved on to competitive horse sports, Gary became the main event. He followed Grandad around the show circuit with his horses Tarzan and Billy Buster. Together, they performed a clowning routine.
We had another drunken act by the name of, well, with Tarzan. Tarzan. I had a bottle of beer and I was staggering along and I couldn't hold the bottle, so I give it to Tarzan. I fell over then because I couldn't stand up. All of a sudden he thought, well, we can't leave. He couldn't leave me there on my own. So he put his head round to the left and he got the rug and he pulled it back over and the rug come off and it come over me. So then he decided, well, I was lying down. I wasn't going to move. So he would lie down alongside of me for the night, and that's where we'd stay.
Gary wakes up and walks around again, but trips over Tarzan's body, landing on the other side. He rests his head on the horse's neck, and once again, Tarzan pulls the rug up to cover him. The trick is more than just a clowning skit. It's a story about the bond between horse and rider, the kind of bond I've grown up with, running out to my pony in the paddock after a bad day at school, or driving hours home from uni on the weekend just to ride my beloved Garnet. With all this new information swarming around in my head, I started to bounce some ideas off my mum in the car one day. Then she hit me with a bombshell. She was in the troop too. She tells me about one trick she did with her cousin Veronica in the early days. It was called going for the cows.
We both go out, both on our own ponies, to chase the cows in, and Veronica's horse steps in a melon hole and she falls off and the horse goes home. So then it's up to me to lie my horse down and pull her onto my horse and then lead her home.
Apparently there was a time when they were practicing at home and Veronica fell into a nest of jumping ants. Terrified of getting up and ruining the act, she lay in the nest, wriggling around as Grandad yelled at her to stay still.
Before that, I used to also do an act called the Dying Stockman Act. So there was a cassette made and it told the story of a stockman who was out. He'd spent a long day mustering a herd of cattle.
All day, a merciless outback sun has followed them. Now, a mile or two more lies the waterhole that they must reach by night. He halts again, his head flung up and ears pricked, sensing the stealthy approach of another horse and rider out of the gathering darkness. He hears the shot ring out, feels the searing pain of the cattle duffer's bullet, and his master drops from his back.
Actually gets shot and falls off the horse, and the horse comes over and lies down next to the rider, and the rider pulls himself up onto the horse, and the horse gets up, and then they wander along for a while, and then eventually the horse collapses and they both lay dead.
But darkness closes and the tracks are lost. They have reached the end of the trail. Grim desert silence surrounds them now, and the horse sinks low to the ground. Nothing to mark this lonely grave or to tell how they have both died.
Mum tells the story almost word for word. At times, it's an echo of the tape. She even tears up a little at the memory.
Make me feel a bit nostalgic just even thinking about it. Yeah, so I guess then eventually we did the vaulting and we all got older, and then the younger cousins did that as well. But as I said, I think times were then changing, and entertainment-wise, they were looking for more acts with more punch, I suppose, than that. So it slowly disappeared.
As time passed, three generations of Mullen's children moved on to different dreams, chasing a career or having children of their own. Before long, the horses, the show and their fame were all just childhood memories, except for my mum.
And now looking, you know, all this way down the track, I'm now the only Mullen's descendant that has got horses. And I sort of see it as a bit of carrying the family genetics.
But it's more than just carrying on tradition. Horses are hard work, especially when you have 30. Thanks to her passion, my sister and I got to live every little girl's dream, with a pony to come home to every day. Even now, while my sister and I are growing up and slowly having less time for horses, she continues to dedicate every day to caring for them. It's that unbreakable bond between girl and horse. She now runs a riding school where local kids come to learn and love our ponies. She gives even more little girls the chance to have their pony dreams come true every single day.
That story was by Emily Bradfield. The supervising producer was Nina Enova with Alison Chan. A special thanks to Caroline Graham for production guidance. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney, in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Krantik Banerjee. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. And I'm Samantha Gross, your host. Shouting Bird composed the theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com, and make sure you subscribe to our podcast.